Today is Thursday. It's October 15th, 2020, the worst year ever. It's 1:39 in the afternoon. And by the way, we always give the time because usually by 1:42 in the afternoon, some crazy new crap has happened, and we want you to know that we could not have known what was going to happen next. Every day, you probably wake up and say, I can't believe this is happening. So I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, which we record every week via Zoom. I'm at WGN Radio, and you can hear me weekdays from 9 to noon. And I did not assign us an order, so let's go Austin, Lisa, Heather, Eric.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
I'm Heather Sharon with WTTW News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the Macho Man columnist from the Tribune who knows how to follow directions.
How does Macho Man fit in there?
Trump is dancing to Macho Man.
Him dancing like this?
I saw the video, but I didn't.
The palms?
Sometimes I can't stand the audio, so I just give myself one or the other. I saw the dance. I didn't know the music. That was after one of his rallies, and he danced a little bit at the end, right? Well, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, so he looked pretty good there, but I listened to some of his interview essentially with the New York Economics Club yesterday, and if he's not infectious, he's certainly not strong in the voice.
Based on the principles of fairness and reciprocity, I ended the NAFTA nightmare and signed the brand new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement into law.
There's not much more you can say about it other than the guy's not completely well, at least in terms of his voice strength. Speaking of which, we're going to lose bragging rights in this state if we keep this up. On October 4th, we had 1,400 new cases. On October 14th, we were at 2,800 new cases. Today, we hit 5,000 new cases in a day of COVID-19. The positivity rate is 4.9. A week ago, we were at 3.7. There's a bunch of statistics like this, 9 days in a row, over 2,000, et cetera. Why is it going through the roof right now?
It's part of a nationwide trend where it's clear that this is sort of the third wave of coronavirus infections. You know, there was the first in March and then a second, mostly in the South and in California, this summer in July. And now this is a third, which really is concentrated in the Midwest. And I don't think that it's a coincidence that all of the states around Illinois are on Chicago's quarantine order, because as bad as it is right now in Illinois, it's worse in Wisconsin, it's worse in Indiana, and it's really bad in Iowa.
Cases are rising in 41 states, and apparently 17 of those states are seeing spikes like they've never seen before. Illinois' one-day report today on the 15th is the highest we've had, I think, in the entire pandemic.
It's a little bit hard to compare because back at the beginning of the pandemic, there was not testing the way that there is right now. So it can be a little bit confusing to sort of compare it. So for example, in Chicago, the number of cases is up 32% over the last week. At the same time, testing is up 16% over that same time period. So it's bad, but you got to keep in mind that the more tests you do, the more infections you're going to discover, which isn't to say that things are moving in the right direction, that they're not. And I think city officials are most concerned that they're seeing increases among people in the 70-year-old range. And we know that those people, like the president, are most at risk of developing severe symptoms and having to be hospitalized and at risk of dying.
Well, also, we had 53 fatalities, which is the most since 64 fatalities in June. I mean, however you play with these numbers, it really looks like we're going in the wrong
positivity
direction.
Rate is up 3.7 to 4.9. Steve Bertrand doesn't join us anymore, but I think the one that bothered Steve more was the hospitalization rate. And at the end of the day, I thought it was the death rate. That would be the ultimate arbiter of are you going up or down, because some people are sicker than others. Some people are affected and you don't know it, but you do know if somebody died. And I don't know if it's that we're back in school and have been for a while. They relaxed the bar and restaurant regulations.
I think it's interesting to see. So I think it was expected that we would see a rebound in cases, and then, but we do need to look at lagging indicators like hospitalizations and deaths. Because like if you look at Europe, who spiked way before us, most of those countries also saw another spike in cases later on. But there's a vast difference, though, in hospitalizations and deaths. So in a place like the UK, you got another spike in deaths with a bunch of spike in cases. Country like Sweden has been continuously on the downturn. Other countries like Germany have been kind of flat. So I think there's still, before we get too worried about positivity rate, I think there needs to be more data in Illinois to see if this is really something that's really serious.
20% in Wisconsin, 20+% in Wisconsin lately, 15.5 in Indiana. And my producer, Pete Zimmerman, that does the business lunch with us, he had seen a show and one of the experts said, we just need to do something really draconian, like a complete shutdown of restaurants and bars and public gatherings for several weeks. You know, we just need to like put the hammer down. I literally don't know if people would behave, and you're not going to throw folks in jail. So I don't know if we're capable of that. I also don't know if that's necessary. Austin, you probably don't think that's necessary, right?
I think what the data show us and what the math shows us is you want to cut down on super spreader events. Like the vast majority of where new breakouts come from are from these single events that have this like big exponential effect. And what the World Health Organization is saying, and there was a great Atlantic article discussing this too, is these kind of blanket stay at home, don't go out lockdown orders are not effective and haven't been shown to be effective really anywhere. So it needs to be a more targeted approach, and it needs to be one that focuses on behaviors like mask wearing and preventing super spreader events rather than, hey, we're just shutting everything down.
Well, everybody give me your wish list. Like if you could just pick one thing that you wish we would all do better.
I mean, everybody has to wear a mask. I mean, I think that we've heard from the CDC, despite its foibles, that, you know, if everybody consistently wore masks, we'd be out of this pandemic within 6 to 8 weeks, simply because it has such an effective way of blocking transmission. And I always think about the study of the hairstylists in Missouri. One of them had the coronavirus, served nearly 200 clients, all of whom wore a mask. She wore a mask, and she transmitted the virus to absolutely no one, despite being in close contact with them.
Well, it just strikes me that Austin's correct that we're looking at these super spreader events. You're looking at parties and mass gatherings and people are clumped together. And that really, if we cut down on those, that people can still shop. People can still dine at some distance from one another. And I think that you could control the spread. What you're seeing, though, is like, I think, was it the University of Chicago Business School, where they had to like basically shut it all down because the students were just all gathering together and partying. A question I have, a very serious question I have, is what we're going to do about Thanksgiving, because people are going to be Thanksgiving is the holiday where people come from all points on the compass to gather together. Often in, you know, older people, younger people, everyone together, and then they gather together for a couple of days, and then they disperse back to their home spots. And I think every family Thanksgiving event like that of any size is potentially a super spreader event. And Dr. Fauci was on Good Morning America today warning people about that, saying maybe we can't do Thanksgiving the way we used to do it. I think people need to rethink all these kinds of gatherings and think about how are we going to keep ourselves safe over the winter, because after Thanksgiving comes Christmas, which is another family holiday where people come from all over the place to get together.
One of the things that they know, it thrives indoors, right? I mean, that's the deal. In addition to sort of the mask measure, everybody wearing a mask, I think we had to look at sort of maybe imposing some of these gathering limits, maybe reimposing some of them. And I don't know what that looks like. I don't want to see small businesses in my community die. I think that is the issue. Indoors, people gathering. You see the people who are sort of strident, and they are very much sort of, you know, they're going to wear the masks every time they walk out the door. I'm one of them. I do find myself sort of taking it off if I'm alone, you know, cruising through an alley or something to get to the Jewel. But just to be, I don't know, committed to that. And I also know people who are strident about, I don't need to wear one. You know, and they're even pointing to the White House and saying, look, it didn't affect him. People, you know, don't realize that he has sort of a top-notch, the president has top-notch health care. And so getting back to the wish list here, I wonder if we shouldn't sort of impose some kind of stricter gathering limits indoors just to get maybe through the end of the year.
My producer was sharing with me this theory that we need something draconian for several weeks, and that would include the federal government just underwriting the businesses and employees. So throw another couple trillion in the pile, but we're just going to have to compensate people. We're all going to have to pay for them to live, and they're not going to open, and we're not going to go there. And if we did that for a couple of months, maybe even longer, but I mean, then we could really whoop this thing.
Austin seems like he knows a little bit about what's going on in Sweden, and I haven't followed Sweden that carefully. I hear various reports about it, but is it your sense that the way Sweden is handling it, Austin, is better than the way we're handling it, or is an alternative, a sensible alternative?
I mean, if we just look at deaths, it's like they had a spike at the beginning, but it's been consistently down, you know, over the last 100, 150 days.
What are they
One
doing?
Average death a day per capita per
100,000.
And then the U.S. is kind of at 680 or something. But Sweden's been consistently down on a downward trend. And yeah, I think it could be a ton of different factors there, right? Like, they've got a healthier population. People have better diets. People are exercising more. People are outside more.
People are smarter.
And maybe in the winter, people are smarter. People are taller. So the virus doesn't affect tall people.
Thank goodness.
So I think, again, you have to focus on these very specific behaviors, which are, you don't want massive conferences where you're spreading it to 1,000 people at a time, because that explodes. That becomes an exponential effect on everybody else. And then you wanted to be able to do simple interventions like mask wearing that really cuts down on spread. I think if you focus on those two things, you're in good shape. If you start talking about stuff like shut everything down and compensate people, I think that's way too extreme. Not only that, I think it's not effective.
Sweden just issued a please stop partying, our cases are going up this morning. I Donald G. McNeil of the New York Times, who I've looked to in this time, has sort of said that this is the traditional sort of hammer and dance, you know, of a pandemic, where, you know, people go out and dance when the cases drop and then the hammer comes down. And it's just sort of, and it seems, you know, with varying degrees, to, you know, that sort of, you know, cycle seems to be happening all over the world.
What was your reaction to the Trump campaign's use of Dr. Fauci?
President Trump is recovering from the coronavirus, and so is America. Together, we rose to meet the challenge, protecting our seniors, getting them life-saving drugs in record time, sparing no expense. President Trump tackled the virus head-on, as leaders should.
I can't imagine that anybody could be doing more.
We'll get through this together. We'll live carefully.
It was out of context. It was taken months ago, and it wasn't talking about the president, but it sure looks like he's talking about the president in the campaign ad. What's your reaction to that, guys?
I thought it was an interesting strategy 3 weeks out from the election to pick a fight with the most revered infectious disease specialist in America.
Well, it could
I don't
be
think
that
he loses anything by doing it. He was just on I just was flipping around and watching part of his rally, the president's rally in North Carolina, and he really sort of played both sides. I love my friend Tony Fauci, but he said not to wear a mask at the beginning of this, and then he said we should, and then he's siding with me, and then he's not, and then I have to ask my other aides, has he done anything so bad that he shouldn't stick around? No, he's my friend. And all the while, people are laughing and alternately booing, and these are his supporters. I mean, we're at the point in the election where it's really playing to the base. It doesn't hurt him.
Yeah, we can wag our fingers all we want. The Democrats should simply respond. They've got more money than Trump, and they should do an ad where they take Fauci's vibrating indignation and play that, and then let the voters see that. I mean, you can't police these kinds of things particularly. Yeah, he took the quote out of context, and that's not the first time a quote's been taken out of context for a political ad. And yes, and Fauci is open to criticism because he has said one thing about masks, then said another. I mean, his position.
The science evolves, though. How is that a legitimate criticism of the fact that he's learned something?
It's not a criticism. I'm saying that you can take somebody position changing due to the evidence and say, or due to the situation on the ground, and make him look like a hypocrite. Rather than Democrats getting all upset about this, they just ought to run their own ads with Fauci and let the chips fall where they may.
Biden did something similar. He took the president out of context using little clips of his speeches saying that he had badly mishandled the coronavirus pandemic. So I think Lisa's point that Trump was speaking to his base is a good one, except he's down by double digits in the polls. So if you're, if the goal is to sort of appeal to people who do not support you at this moment, I don't know how that helps him.
Yeah, boy, we choose
to be aiming that way. And he seems to insist his own polls show I'm only up by 6%. What's wrong with you guys? So I don't think he sees it that way.
Those of you who are interested in polls should take a look at my column at ChicagoTribune.com. which should be posting this afternoon. It'll be by the time this podcast posts, it will have posted. And what it does is it looks at the polls in mid-October of 2016, where Hillary Clinton stood as regards to Joe Biden, particularly in the key swing states or the battleground states. And Hillary Clinton had a bigger advantage in the battleground states then than Joe Biden has now. Donald Trump closed that gap and won a lot of those key states, most of those key states, in the last 3 weeks of the election. For one reason or another, those mid-October polls were not particularly reliable. And anybody who, like me, was complacent in the middle of October and thought, well, this is over. Let's talk about what color drapes the Clinton should put and what we should call Bill Clinton now that he's the first gentleman, need to really rethink what's going on, because we are in a very, very similar position than we were 4 years ago, poll-wise.
So I will push back a little bit on you on that, Eric, in that I think the fundamental problems with the state polls in 2016 was that it was not properly weighting for education. And I think that was why the state polls were significantly off, but the national polls were pretty much dead on. And I think that it is a horse of a different color to have national polls showing Biden up somewhere between 11 or 12 points and having Clinton's maximum lead be up 6 points. I don't think you can compare the two. And I think comparing polls in 2016 and 2020 are apples and oranges just because the internals are so completely different. I mean, if your point is don't measure the drapes, sure. But I'm just saying that, like, there's a reason that the polls in 2016 were wrong, and that is, and the pollsters have adjusted themselves for 2020. So I think it's important to recognize that.
From your lips to voters' ears, Heather.
There, I was just watching something about this on MSNBC the other night. I believe it was MSNBC, where they were talking about how some of the polling, they hope that they recalibrated correctly, that they're still not getting the responses from some of the blue collar working men or white men with no college degree, because they simply don't want to be polled. They hang up. They don't want to talk. So you either get sort of, we're not reaching the right people, or Trump is under polling, and then they hope that they've recalibrated, but they don't know.
It's also important to think back all the way to 2012, when the polls were off by just as much, right, but in the direction of Barack Obama. So it was less of a shock to everybody than it was in 2016.
Well, the Access Hollywood tape didn't move the needle in 2016, but maybe the ongoing handling of the Hillary Clinton email thing did. And I'm wondering if the Hunter Biden story has that kind of heft, if that is going to be a factor. If Trump has a 3-week swing here, Eric, do you think this Hunter Biden story has any traction?
I doubt it. I'm sure there are a number of people who are animated by it, but from everything that I've read about it right now, it seems very dodgy. You can summarize the story, John. You summarized it for us earlier, but it was like, that these laptop computers were delivered by somebody who might have been Hunter Biden, and it had like Hunter Biden stickers on them in a Delaware computer repair shop. And
well, here's what I wrote, Eric, just because this is my note on it. In April of last year, and this may or may not have happened, Hunter Biden dropped off what I read was 3 laptop computers at a shop in Wilmington, Delaware. One of them may have had a Bo Biden, I think, foundation sticker on there. 2 of the computers weren't salvageable, but the guy trying to fix them was able to see information on one. Hunter never came back to pick up these computers for some reason. The guy with the computers, John McIsaac, saw troubling information on the computers, he said, email and photos. McIsaac gave the computers to someone else who gave them to Rudy Giuliani. The New York Post published some email that suggested that maybe a meeting might happen between Vice President then Biden and some Ukrainians. McIsaac isn't 100% sure it was Biden that brought him in. He's legally blind, this guy, and the Post has not given the computers to anyone to verify the story. I'm not sure how much of what I said is true, so you're getting it third hand from me. But
well, you're getting the summary correct. That's exactly what I read in the New York Post and some of the Washington Post analysis of it. So that's the thrust of it. Now, whether any of this moves the needle, I'm not sure. I kind of feel like there's so many questions about the New York Post reporting, their sourcing. What is it? Traces back to Trump's attorney, old Rudy Giuliani. It's just unclear whether these emails are legit.
Well, there are two prongs to this scandal, this alleged scandal, right? One is that Hunter Biden got this job with Burisma, the Ukrainian energy company that he was absolutely not qualified for, and he was paid an obscene amount of money to do essentially no work. And we are supposed to be shocked that some foreign entity would be willing to try to cozy up to the vice president's family in such a way. And again, if we're shocked by any kind of grifting and by family members of prominent politicians, we're going to be in a perpetual state of shock. The other accusation is that Joe Biden acted to fire the prosecutor or forced Ukraine to fire his prosecutor because this prosecutor was allegedly looking into what was going on at the energy company Burisma, and that he did this in order to protect his son's interests. And everybody who's looked into this, every serious journalist who's looked into this realizes that the desire to have this prosecutor fired was a desire that was held by most of the Western world, and it was at the direction of the United States government and others to fire this prosecutor. So that part of the accusation doesn't really hold up. So you've got these two elements of this story, neither of which are particularly scandalous. And again, it's kind of in the weeds when you're talking about 3 weeks to go until the election. I don't see it really moving the ball much.
Well, isn't there a third prong? And that's what Biden was very adamant in saying, that he never discussed his son's business dealings with his son. And if these emails turn out to be true, I think that would fly in the face of that a little bit, especially if the ones that came out this morning about there was emails with a Chinese energy company that basically said, here's how we want to distribute the equity. You know, you get X percent and then 10% goes to your old man. And again, that's if any of this turns out to be true. But I think we should probably all shut up about talking about it until we have some independent people come on the podcast and tell us whether or not we should even be discussing this.
So I think that the story about Hunter Biden leaving these computers and then the guy he left them with just happened to turn them over to Giuliani defies logic and credulity. And let's not forget that we know from the federal government, from the intelligence agencies, that Burisma itself was hacked by pro-Russian intelligence agencies. And I think it is very much an open question as to whether or not these emails came from that hack. The email that was reported on the New York Post yesterday is basically an email from this guy who there's no record of he ever met Biden. And we know that Biden never profited from any of this work because we've seen his tax returns. Like he did not report any earnings of this. And all the email that was published yesterday in the New York Post said was this guy saying, thank you for, offering to introduce me to your father, when there's no evidence that's the text, or that meeting occurred.
Yeah, words to that effect are the text that the Post itself published about the email, right?
Right.
But importantly, though, the Biden folks didn't say we didn't meet with this person. They said there's no official record.
He absolutely did say we've never heard of this guy. We never met with him. Here are our official schedules. We did not meet with this guy at all.
I think it was more a point of this was not an official
No,
there was not a blanket denunciation.
No, they blanketly denied meeting with this guy.
Who's the they in that, Heather?
Biden's campaign, okay. and his foreign policy advisor back in 2015 when this was supposed to have been happening. He said, no, this is all of the schedules. We've never heard of this.
Right. So I've already voted. It doesn't matter. But if all of this were true, Hunter Biden's not on the ballot. It sounds desperate to me if this is what the Trump campaign needs to win, because I don't like this Hunter Biden thing, but I still don't. It would not move my vote. I'm not one of the 12 people that's undecided.
The comment I keep hearing from people, commentators, pundits, et cetera, is that this is too complicated for people to understand sort of how all this.
Yeah.
A, it's complicated. B, it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, John, which is sort of like, okay, we expect that there's a little bit of back scratching, and I've met with you and I've met with them. Now, where it goes over the line, you know, we don't want to see that, but certainly people meet with each other and that's expected. And I think people don't understand it beyond that.
Speaking of voting, and I did, I'm sensing a lot of anxiety from my listeners. And Heather, I don't know if your viewers or Lisa, your readers, guys, but I mean, as the closer we get to election, people have, you know, maybe three options. You can stand in line and vote on election day, but then you're nervous about the COVID. You can mail it in, but then you're nervous about the postal service. You can drop it in a box, but you're not clear about how that works. And a lot of people are anxious about even getting their ballots or getting confirmation that the ballot has been received. There's just very little confidence about the process this year. And it's at a fever pitch. I put a lot of the county clerks on from all around the metropolitan area every week, sometimes twice a week, sometimes twice a day. We did two today, Cook and Boone County. And the phone lines just light up with people like this is oxygen for them. They need this information. And everybody, it seems, has some either complaint or concern.
I got a frantic email from a woman saying, I applied for my mail-in ballot from the Cook County clerk. I haven't gotten it. I can't track it online. It's been stolen by some nefarious force. Please, Heather, look into this for me. And I emailed her back, and she's like, well, it came in the mail today. Thanks very much.
We've been responding to popular demand on this and trying to put out just like very basic voting information stuff. So we put up something yesterday that was basically like, how do I verify my vote was counted? Do you know you can contact your election authority and, you know, ask them about those things? Yeah, I think it's, people are really concerned about it. It's a new process, especially in Illinois. We're not used to this. Not so many people in Illinois are used to doing this as they're doing it currently. Also, one thing, just looked up Politico story from last night. Biden's campaign would not rule out the possibility that the former VP had some kind of informal interaction with Pazarsky, which wouldn't appear on Biden's official schedule.
So
any encounter would have been cursory.
Yeah, but an informal interaction, you can't know who everybody whose hand you've shaken walking through a conference hall. The email in the New York Post, and I don't mean to belabor this, said that, look, this is an official action when we're going to do crimes. Thank you for letting me meet your, you know, your father to do crimes.
Right. And I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, Austin. It's just, I read the same thing too, where he said, no, never happened. We did not meet. I'm not saying that he is absolutely right or correct, or that piece of paper gives him sort of this pass or anything. I'm just saying that he has said, no, we never happened, and here's the proof.
By the way, Austin, so that general sort of FAQ that you all have posted, is that at illinoispolicy.org? Is that the way to get that?
So we're going to be keep rolling out stuff as more people's questions come in. But yeah, it's remarkable. And it's also like we're kind of running up against this thing that we kind of did during COVID, right? Where similar to how, you know, 10 million people applied for unemployment, or what, it's not 10 million, but tons more people than have ever applied for unemployment have applied. And these systems are so antiquated, and it's like sort of the same thing with mail-in voting. It's like, you know, there's new funding allocated for this, but all these systems are old. These county election boards are all fragmented and not really working together that well. So I anticipate it continuing to be a mess.
And I know the Channel 11, WTTW TV, and the Chicago Tribune have also posted a lot of helpful, I think, election information. Click on any of the sites. At the end of the day, I do have 97% confidence that all the votes will be counted. They'll be counted accurately and that there won't be much cheating. My number's 97. And most years, I think it's 97. I understand the anxiety, but I still have some sort of confidence in the best efforts and intentions of people. Lisa, are you with me on that? Are you at 97?
Well, I think you might have caused me a little bit of anxiety about voting.
I just lowered your own number.
When I said I ordered a mail-in ballot because I was trying to protect the health of somebody in my household. And I don't know if it was you or it may have been somebody else said, I'm not sure. I'm worried about that, you know, about sort of the surety of that particular process working. And so I am looking at my ballot still right now.
You haven't dropped it in the mail yet?
No, I have not.
How long have you had it?
The deadline of October 15th, which is today.
Yeah.
Today. Right.
Well, people are looking for a safe place to go vote. I might recommend on a Monday or Friday going to the Loop Super site, which was empty, completely empty when I went on Monday. And I mean, the Loop is, there's nobody there.
Austin, I was at City Hall yesterday get my vehicle sticker. There was three people. When's the last time to get a vehicle sticker you could get in and out in 3 minutes? It's very convenient if you're willing to risk coming into Chicago.
Yeah, I think the voting in Illinois is going to be handled pretty well because we're not going to be a battleground state. There's not going to be a lot of national attention focused on our races. I don't think there's going to be a lot of claims of fraud that we're going to have to deal with. It may be slow coming in. We may not know the results of certain key races. It's possible that the graduated income tax referendum won't be immediately known. The results of that won't be immediately known. But for the most part, I have confidence. My confidence is probably even higher than 97%. I'll bet 99% or more of a vote will be counted correctly, ultimately. I have confidence in our election system. I don't have that much confidence in its speed.
What I think that we have to be worried about is if it is close in states like Florida and Pennsylvania, where the election authorities have a vested interest in the outcome, I think then it raises the possibility that we're back in Florida 2000 territory, where you would have sort of an official try to cut a recount or, you know, some other, you know, thing short to sort of limit the ability for all of the votes to be counted. However, that is only if it is, you know, just super, super, super close. Really, the only swing state that won't start counting votes early is Pennsylvania. So Florida counts votes as they come in, and then they will release those, you know, totals after the polls close at 8 o'clock. So really, we will know relatively soon whether Florida is close. I think if Florida is close, then all bets are off. But if Florida is not close, and we should know that by about midnight on election night, I think that that will sort of determine whether we're going to see a lot of shenanigans, for lack of a more serious term.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because Illinois, the mail-in ballots, as they come in, they feed them in the machine, they're tabulated, but the number isn't released or even revealed. But all they got to do is hit a button, and then it calculates that fairly quickly. I've been under the impression that there's this big lag between mail-in ballots all being sorted and counted, or some process happening.
Well, there is in some states. So Michigan, there will also be a lag. So they will start sort of processing the ballots, but they won't start counting the ballots until after the polls close.
Well,
So we won't know Michigan for a while. And Pennsylvania is the worst. They don't start processing any ballot until after the polls close.
Well, Lisa, maybe you should mute your speaker, because I'm going to say this. If I was in a swing state where I thought my vote really counted, if I was in North Carolina or one of these states, I would be voting in person on Election Day. But I'm like, well, what's the worst that can happen? I'm 97% sure it's going to go fine. And if it doesn't, they don't need my vote that much in Illinois anyway. I didn't even have, almost all the races I had were one box. It was one box. Illinois is going to go blue. So if I want to vote for Joe Biden and they don't count it, it doesn't worry me, right? But if I was in a swing state, I think I might feel differently about it.
Isn't that the thing that kind of got people into trouble last time? Like, it doesn't matter. I don't need to go out and vote. So people on the losing side of things are, I think, argued some of the same things. So, but they, right, you're right. We are a blue state, at least in Chicago.
Yeah. I think people are going to show up more to vote on graduated income tax.
I think the fair tax right now is sort of the big draw. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable how much, in the way you've seen TV advertising on that.
It's the only one, though, that we get much of. I mean, at least we're spared. I got family in Arizona. They're getting presidential ads all the time. You know, we got to watch them on YouTube or the internet to see them. So I guess we're lucky that way. Let's talk about the county budget a little bit, because that's really interesting to me. And I know you wonks are wanting to talk about this. So why do I care about this county budget meeting, or what the hell you people were talking about?
Cook County government funds the region's charity public health care system, which is more in more demand probably than in some time because of the tanking economy and the COVID-19 pandemic. And it also funds our criminal justice system. That is why we care about it. And like every other local government, state government, they are seeing revenues dry up because of the shutdown orders. So they're not getting those revenues, the sales tax and so forth. There's concerns about the property tax revenues drying up as well. So right now, it looks like Preckwinkle is going to dip into reserves to use some of that money that's sort of in the rainy day fund to bridge this. I believe it's almost a $500 million gap. But
$410 million. Mm-hmm. And about half of that is the county's general fund, and about another half of the deficit is the Cook County Health Services, which runs Strozier Hospital and Provident Hospital. And what's really interesting is that the bulk of the cuts are really coming from a decision to eliminate almost 700 vacant positions. And most of those positions are in the Cook County Jail. And the sheriff isn't objecting to those cuts because those positions are no longer needed because the jail population has come down by, you know, almost 45% by some accounts. So that's sort of one of the saving graces to this budget that has given Preckwinkle the ability to sort of, you know, as she said this morning, sort of weather the storm. But I think she also sounded another warning sign because, you know, we've all been watching the Amy Coney Barrett, you know, Supreme Court confirmation hearings and all of the talk about the Affordable Care Act. You know, if the Affordable Care Act is overturned by the Supreme Court, Cook County is in a world of pain because that money has really helped the hospital systems stay solvent. And without those funds, there's literally no good option for the county to keep offering nearly $400 million in charity care every year. So I think that's also a concern. But, you know, we talked earlier about how cases are surging. The longer the pandemic lasts, the more tax revenue this county is going to lose, and the worse sort of the ultimate toll is going to be. So, you know, it's sort of I was sort of like, oh, no new taxes. Well, that's the headline.
I was struck by the fact that she said that the pandemic has dealt Cook County and its residents a catastrophic blow, but Cook County cannot absorb another financial calamity in 2021. And we are staring down the barrel of the gun at another financial calamity, another pandemic calamity in 2021. As we spoke about earlier, it doesn't really look like we have turned the corner yet. And so I'm not sure what gives anybody any optimism that this calamity isn't going to strike.
Well, I mean, I think the hope is that we're going to have a vaccine.
And I'm seeing reports that less than half of the members of the public right now would be willing to take such a vaccine.
So I am skeptical of those poll numbers simply because this is a theoretical vaccine that we haven't seen gone through the safety protocols. And I think that, you know, if you look at what happened back in the 1950s with the polio vaccine, you saw very similar numbers of people saying, no, I'm not going to give this vaccine to my child. Are you crazy? But then after the first wave of vaccinations didn't result in any, you know, sort of adverse effects, everybody got vaccinated. And I suspect we'll see a very similar pattern.
Kind of intrigued by the math of that, because they're saying a vaccine might be 50% effective. So Does that mean that you've reduced by half your chances? Mr. Math is smiling over there, but does that mean that we've reduced by half your chances of getting COVID-19 if you go out? And does that make you want to get on the L? I'm disappointed that that's all we got, that that's our knight in shining armor.
I don't know anything else to say about the math of that. I will say I agree with Heather. Like, the asking people if they want a hypothetical magic potion that makes COVID go away, most people are going to be like, huh? Oh, you want to inject me with what? So I think, and there's lots of interesting public health research, especially around like infectious diseases and socially how it's really important to be a socially acceptable thing to get treatment for, a socially acceptable thing to get a vaccine for.
Yeah,
that would be a really crucial part of the efficacy of a vaccine.
Well, this whole thing is complicated a bit by the fact that the whole idea of the vaccine has been politicized, with Trump keeps talking about that we're going to have it, you know, in the next couple of weeks, when I think people who know anything about medicine and science know that vaccines take a long time to develop and develop safely. And there's this fear that, and it's been articulated by Kamala Harris and by Biden and others, which is that if Donald Trump comes up and says, look, here's a vaccine, take it, I'm not going to take it. If Dr. Fauci and some of the people who you come to trust say, hey, this vaccine works, then more people will take it. And I think Heather's right that if it is discovered to be, you know, let's say 75% effective or more, that people realize this is really helping, this is letting us go about our business in a safe fashion, that people will take it and that it will succeed. But I don't see that happening in 3 months. I could see that kind of things playing out until we get to next spring, maybe. This is circling back then to the Cook County budget problem, which is like.
So when I say 3 to 6 months, I mean like the first doses rolling out to like healthcare workers and emergency room physicians and that sort of thing. But I think the sense is that the economists say, look, if people know that there's a vaccine out there, if they can see the light at the end of the tunnel in a way mm-hmm. that we can't see it right now, mm-hmm. they will be more willing to go out and spend and, you know, maybe, you know, buy a new car or replace that dishwasher in a way that they aren't right now.
But you guys, this is not I'm not baiting you guys with this, but hasn't the president said all along that he's going to roll out a health plan and that it's going to come out in 2 weeks? Wasn't that like when he got elected, day one, we're going to get a new health plan, it'll be better than Obamacare? I don't even know what a new health plan means anyway, right? But I mean, has that happened in smaller pieces that I haven't paid any attention to?
Nope.
I don't know if that's something to capitalize on or talk more about if you're the Biden campaign, but seriously, well, he's been saying 2 weeks for 200 weeks.
He talks about it all the time. It's not getting media attention, though, because we've all written that story. I know Lisa feels my pain on this. We've all written there is no alternative to Obamacare, and Biden is calling, you know, Trump out on that. You know, there's just, you know, there was a reason why we saw every Republican senator during the Coney Barrett hearing saying, oh, come on, the Supreme Court's not really going to strike down Obamacare. But the fact of the matter is that they very well might, especially if Coney Barrett is confirmed and she votes on the case.
John, you're right about that. And it intrigues me that so much attention has been paid to Biden's refusal to talk about, you know, court packing or court balancing. Biden won't answer questions about that. But when you ask Mike Pence or Donald Trump in these forums, what is your health plan? And specifically, when you're talking about what is your health plan, the idea is, what is your plan to take care of people who have pre-existing conditions, who are otherwise uninsurable? And this is what Obamacare really fundamentally is all about. And if you remove that protection, you know, Trump swears that he's going to protect these people, but how is he going to do it? Because, you know, these are very expensive conditions that a lot of people have. And cracking that nut, that's one of the reasons why Obamacare is such a, you know, Jenga tower of proposals, is because they're trying to do it while still preserving the private insurance system. And again, you know, Trump has come out. He had a declaration sometime last month in September where he said basically it was a long proclamation saying, yeah, we're going to protect people with pre-existing conditions because if you have a medical condition, you shouldn't have to pay more. Well, OK, fine. How do you do that?
Austin, you've always described these debates as dueling press conferences, and you've told us why you don't like them. And I don't know if anybody does, but tonight we're going to get dueling press conferences. Is this a better version of us trying to get some information from the president and the candidate? Do you like what's going to happen tonight on TV?
I think everybody should just listen to me and Eric's debate about the progressive tax. About, I don't know, 50 minutes. You'll learn a lot, I'm sure. You won't. There's no insults. You don't talk over each other. It's great. So no, I have zero expectations for what will happen.
I have huge problems with the fact that NBC is going ahead with this thing last minute, you know, at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock our time, when ABC had already planned their town hall with Biden. So I'll go back. I'm having a problem with NBC having scheduled this last minute town hall with Trump when ABC had already scheduled theirs with Biden.
That's the problem, though, right? That's your problem, Lisa. It's not that they're doing it. It's that they're doing it at the same time.
They're doing it at the same time. And yeah, I know that I can watch one and then look at YouTube afterward. I don't want to have to do that. I think it hurts the media. I think that that's where I'm at. I think it hurts us. I think it makes it look like, okay, somebody's playing make a deal. And clearly, all of us have had sources who say, I'm embargoing this story, trying to torpedo somebody else out of the water. And you have to sort of fish through and find out, well, why do they want us to wait? And why are they asking that? And, you know, pushing back on it, saying, no, I don't want that or something. But I think NBC could have scheduled this for another night, so that it doesn't look like they're doing somebody's work for them. Now, I know NBC had this sit down with Biden a week ago. They had the town hall with him. They're trying to be fair, but I just think that they could have found another time.
I think it could be fine. Actually, I think that if you have good moderators or interrogators, whatever, you have the person who's running the program, make sure that there are time for follow-up questions, that you actually are going to allow the candidate to answer the question and to be followed up with, and you're not going to have somebody else trying to interrupt and sigh and shake his head and call him a liar and a clown. It could be a lot more informative, even though it's not going to be as dramatic. I mean, we all complained about what a crap show the first debate was, and that's probably because they were talking over each other and yelling at each other the whole time. I think it's potentially more informative to have one of these sort of, you know, one person on stage at a time.
Did you watch the town hall earlier?
Biden?
Trump did a town hall too with CNN.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I mean, a woman talked about how a relative died of breast cancer and he said, I'm so sorry, she died of COVID-19. And that poor woman was like,
that's why it depends on the moderator. The moderator is going to have to listen and follow up and ask questions and not let them wriggle off the hook. I thought there was one with ABC and Stephanopoulos was the moderator.
Yeah.
Am I wrong about that? But anyway, there was one where basically Trump just filibustered him or her. I just don't remember which one it was. But you really need a good moderator who's going to hold the candidate's feet.
Well, good luck.
So like I said, it could be.
Good luck. Good luck. I don't know if anybody saw, I'm sure you all did, Biden's last town hall, and I believe that was the NBC one in Florida. I think, was it Lester Holt that was trying to do it? He kept trying to sort of get Biden to answer the questions. And these were sort of, a lot of them were softballs.
They were.
One question,
they were.
Not a single question was answered.
And did the vice president answer those questions, though, when Lester pushed back? Did he, in fact, engage?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Do you know how many people, I saw the ratings, and I think this is what the president's going to crow about. Savannah Guthrie, I think, is moderating the NBC one tonight, and I think he's going to have her for a snack. The 70 million people almost watched the debate, and about 6.5 million people watched the town hall meeting. I don't know who's going to get more viewers. But
It's going to be Trump.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I
put my money on that.
It.
Yeah.
They're simulcasting on MSNBC and CNBC. So it's, you know, it's just Matt.
Well, you
have no often.
Okay, but if you have to watch one, if you have to watch one, you only get to watch one.
I'm going to continue watching Borgen, the great Danish political drama, now on Netflix.
Nope.
Oh, my God. You know, the thing is, I think, I know you want to button us down on this, but I do think people are going to watch Trump, even if they're, you know, even non-supporters. I think people want to know how he's doing health-wise.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a draw, too. And here he's going to be on network TV.
Yeah, if I have to watch one live, it's going to be Trump, because you just never know what the guy's going to say. And I think that's one reason why he gets so many people out at his rallies, is because he's unpredictable. He's going to say things that are, that will shock you. Biden is going to Biden. You know, he's going, you're going to, if he says anything really interesting or has any gaffes, we'll hear about it the next day or later in the news cycle. And it's not going to be really worth watching the whole thing. I'm just more interested to see if there's any sort of train wreck aspect to Trump. It's more fascinating. It's like, do you want to slow down for a car accident or a flat tire? And essentially Biden's a flat tire and Trump is the car.
Well, I don't see that much of Joe Biden. I don't watch these things that closely unless I have to, but I'm not super encouraged by Joe Biden's performance out there. For instance, you know, there was some interest in whether or not he said that he was running for Senate. And two videos surfaced, one where he did, but it was back when he was running for Senate. Another time his grammar was tortured and he repaired it on the fly.
I'm running as a proud Democrat for the Senate. When I run as a proud Democrat for vice president, I'm running as a proud Democrat for president. But I promise you this, I will govern as an American president.
I do that all the time, but forget about that. I am not impressed, and we've talked about that a lot on this podcast, and maybe it's attributable to his speech impediment over the years, but I'm just not impressed with his performance or his fact-finding. He's not inspiring out there.
I don't think he's ever been a great public speaker, though. I don't think that anybody is ever going to remember him for that. I think that you saw him early on when Obama... President Obama picked him to be his running mate. People like, the stories came out like how he's kind of the king of gaffes. He's not really a great president. He's a great orator, that he's affable, but he's not a great orator. That he actually is a smart guy. He knows about policy, but he doesn't seem to be able to present very well.
Absent a really major gaffe or just a brain freeze, mm-hmm. where he, like the other day, apparently somebody asked him about the 2012 race and he couldn't remember Romney's name.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing happens to people, happens to everybody, where it's like a name that ought to be right there just vanishes.
I came within about 10 seconds of live TV last night referring to Judge Alito as Judge Scalia, who is super dead. And I just managed to make my brain say Alito before I said Scalia.
And I would still vote for you, Heather.
I already did.
You voted for Heather. Wow. What a compliment. I will close with this. Did you guys see Rolling Stone has their RS 100, the Hot 100 Songs in America, when they combine online sales with some other kind of sales? So it's like, what is the number one song that people are purchasing and listening to in America? Cardi B's WAP is number one. Guess what number two is? And it's something that's pretty viral and trending right now.
I know.
Fleetwood
Mac, baby.
Yeah. I am so into all of these videos. Mick Fleetwood and Stevie Nicks have both posted homages to the people who posted homages to them. And my favorite one of late is that Lanny Gardner. I don't know if you've watched her. She's a 21-year-old singer who has a lot of views on YouTube and elsewhere. Pretty good singer, but she just sat on her bed one day and did Dreams and kills it.
Listen carefully to the sound of loneliness, like a heartbeat drives you mad.
And sales of Fleetwood Mac albums are through the roof this week as a result of this funny little phenomenon. People drinking cranberry juice and jamming out to the music. And
can I just say, I'm so glad that the TikTok guy didn't turn out to be like a secret white supremacist with locked in his basement. And
we regret to inform you.
It turns out he just loves weed.
Right? That's fine. He's just chill, man.
I'm on a personal mission to make a different Stevie Nicks video go viral. And I will give Bits and Grassles an exclusive. If you look at YouTube and search Stevie Nicks Wild Heart, there's a video of Stevie Nicks getting her makeup done, her hair done for a photo shoot. And she sings Wild Heart. And it's like one of the most entrancing things.
Wow. Lisa, you probably aren't listening to any music. You're dialed in. You're
a little bit. I
tabulating
miss it.
Thoughts.
Yeah, I miss it. Yep.
But what about the Zorns? Eric's probably just playing it on his front porch.
Yeah, we're still playing. We played last night in the front porch. And our son and I have to play fiddle tunes on the front porch. None you've ever heard of, though. I'm just wondering, where did Kung Fu Fighting end up on Rolling Stones?
It's number three. Yeah, I'm glad you asked. It's now number three. That's how we're going to make that thing pop. Eric and Lisa and Heather and Austin were produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.